Come celebrate Halloween with Time's Up, a 15-year-old nonprofit environmental organization. On Friday, October 25th at 7 p.m., bike or skate to Union Square in your spookiest costume to join in the New York City Halloween Critical Mass Ride. Or join us later starting at 8 p.m. for the Halloween Dance Party at Walker Stage, 56 Walker Street. For more information, call Time's Up at 212-802-8222 or visit times-up.org. Remember, Friday, October 25th for the Time's Up Halloween Dance Party and Critical Mass Bike Ride. This has been a public service announcement courtesy of WBAI New York.
And it is 1 minute after midnight in New York City, and you're tuned to listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM. Please stay tuned for the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade.
Hiya, friends. Ralph Sportsport Motors, is the world's largest new used and used automobile dealership.
What?
Ralph Sportsport Motors here.
Not at all what I intended to play. What on earth is this?
Let's look at the extras on this fabulous car.
There, that's better. Turn down the mics.
Maria,
Welcome aboard to the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Yes, Bill Weinberg is back, and Anne-Marie Hendrickson is taking the night off, so we're doing a little switcheroo this evening, and we might switch back again next week. Seems to be on something of an alternating current here. And our opening cut after our opening snafu, in which we heard around 10 seconds of the Fire Sign Theater, with me and Bob sounding extremely befuddled, trying to figure out what was going on over it. After we got over that little requisite snafu, we heard Cunctissimus Concanentes Ave Maria. Let us all sing together Hail Mary, which some uncharacteristically Catholic music here on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, but there is a connection to some of the ongoing themes and obsessions of this particular show. From a record entitled The Black Madonna, Pilgrim Songs from the Monastery of Montserrat, 1400 to 1420 by the Unicorn Ensemble, from the Early Music label, in Latin, of course, part of a cycle of medieval pilgrim songs from Catalonia, all having to do with Montserrat, which is the sacred mountain of Catalonia, in Spain. Although the ethnic identity of the Catalans and their degree of autonomy from Madrid continues to be an extremely controversial issue, even right up to the current day. Montserrat is the sacred mountain of Catalonia, and where the Black Madonna, the Black Virgin of Montserrat, was apparently mysteriously found back in the 9th century in a cave up on the mountain. And today there is a cathedral and a monastery and a shrine and all that. And I have to confess that, yes, I was in Catalonia. That's where I've been for the past 2 weeks. An extravagance on my part. Having never been to Europe in my life, I've now gone to Europe twice in the course of a single year, as our listeners are aware now. I am living beyond my means. It is an extravagance. I don't know how I am going to pay the rent this winter, but I have my reasons. Let's just leave it at that. So I visited Montserrat, among other things, and Montserrat was a point of pilgrimage for hundreds of years after the liberation of Catalonia from the Moorish occupation of Spain. Catalonia was liberated much earlier than much of the rest of Spain, certainly much earlier than Andalusia, which was not liberated, quote-unquote, until 1492, as we know. And this mountain is an extremely impressive place. The actual shape of the rocks is rather reminiscent of a lot of places in the American Southwest. If anybody out there has been to Bryce Canyon in Utah, for instance, you get the same sort of these sort of natural spires of rock just like jutting up into the sky like giant fingers of stone. And it's the same sort of reddish stone, a sort of sandstone, certainly sandstone out west. And I think it might be in Montserrat as well. Very evocative of parts of the American Southwest. And the story goes, the legend of Montserrat has it that when Wilfred the Hairy, the national hero of Catalonia, was fighting for the with the backing of Empire Charlemagne, the Frankish Empire, against the Moors to liberate Catalonia from the Christian viewpoint. Well, there were all of these stories that the Moors brought all of these terrible creatures out of Africa to terrorize the Christians. They brought dragons and giants and so forth. And Wilfred the Hairy had all of these exploits in defeating them. And among them were an army of giants, which the Moors brought from the north of Africa to Catalonia. And when the Moors were defeated in Catalonia and driven out, and Christianity was restored, the giants were turned into stone. And yeah, you guessed it, all of these huge stone spires at the top of Montserrat are these giants which were magically, by the grace of God, turned into stone. So right away, you know, how do we interpret this? Well, it could be just a good story, but usually there's something behind such stories. And what might be behind this story is that, in fact, this mountain was a Moorish stronghold. The transformation of the giants into these spires of stone on the mountain might actually speak to the fact that this mountain had actually been a Moorish stronghold back in the day, and they had to come up with a good story to explain it away after the fact. And then, of course, about 200 years after Wilfred the Hairy's victory, it would have been the 9th century, the Black Madonna was mysteriously found ready-made in a cave on the side of the mountain. And there's now a shrine where this cave used to be, and the Black Madonna itself sits in a cathedral which was built at the top of the mountain, and is still a point of pilgrimage today. And if you visit it, you can see all of the offerings which people from, primarily from Catalonia, but also from elsewhere in Spain and from France, all the offerings which people have left to the Virgin, along with their prayers for better luck and for the resolving of their personal crises, appeals to the Virgin. What's extremely interesting is that it's a black Virgin, and generally, you know, the story is there's a whole series of black Christs in the Western Hemisphere, stretching from the black Christ of Chimayo in New Mexico, all the way down to the Black Christ of Esquipulas in Guatemala, which is also a point of pilgrimage for Indians from all over Central America and Southern Mexico, even today, and was, because of its religious significance, where the Central American Peace Dialogue was brokered in the 1980s. Successful peace dialogue, which finally did bring an end to the guerrilla wars which were being waged in the isthmus. And generally, the widely accepted theory behind the black Christs of Mesoamerica, greater Mesoamerica, we might say, stretching all the way from Guatemala to New Mexico, is that they were, despite the supposedly miraculous origins, that they were, in fact, an effort on the part of the Spanish colonizers to create idols which had the same skin tone as the people who that they were trying to convert, that is to say, the Indians, the Maya Indians in Guatemala and the Pueblo Indians in New Mexico. And we might hypothesize that something similar was going on with the Black Virgin of Montserrat, if we are going to assume, as perhaps is the truth behind the legend, that Montserrat had been a Moorish stronghold, then perhaps the existence of a black virgin there was part of a strategy to convert and to pacify the Moorish inhabitants of the region. So these were among the mysteries which perhaps we will explore this evening. Another element of this, of course, is in addition to the Moorish connection, there is also perhaps a pagan connection, a pre-Christian connection, as was the case so often with, well, certainly with the version of Guadalupe in Mexico. We all know the story of how the Aztec earth goddess Tonantzin was actually the pre-Columbian or pre-Hispanic reality behind the version of Guadalupe. And in fact, the version of Guadalupe had been discovered by Juan Diego, who was recently ascended to sainthood, the first indigenous person of the Western Hemisphere to ascend to sainthood in the Catholic Church. And he found or saw his vision of the version of Guadalupe precisely where an ancient Aztec shrine to the earth goddess Tonantzin had been. Perhaps there were similar things going on Montserrat. In the same cycle of medieval pilgrim songs associated with Montserrat, there is one which was extremely popular entitled the Cante la Sibila, which was part of a dramatic work entitled The Procession of the Prophets, reading from the liner notes here, from another disc I picked up entitled Drames Litúrgicas de la Catalunya Medieval. And I'm trying to pronounce Catalan here, which is not quite the same as Spanish. So if there's any Catalan listeners out there, forgive me if I'm mangling your tongue. But performed as a whole or in part during the Christmas Mass, while standing in front of the Old and New Testament prophets, Christ and the three Marys, the Sibyl was a pagan prophetess of ancient Greece, who in this work sings an apocalyptic text about the last judgment, which St. Augustine attributed to her. Her prophecy became an essential part of many churches, originating in the work the Sue d'Urgel from Valencia. And this song was part of the liturgy for centuries, evoking as it does the medieval fear of divine punishment. By the Renaissance, people had lost their respect in the Sibyl. She was little more than folkloric figure rather than a spiritual one. And the Council of Trent, which convened in 1545, ostensibly to crush Protestant heresy within the church, also hastened her demise and eliminated her song. So the Council of Trent was also apparently somewhat aimed at crushing pagan remnants, which continued to survive in medieval Catholicism. So, and Sibyl was part of, you know, the more general tradition of goddess worship throughout the Mediterranean world, which also took on the form of Gaia and Isis and others, which perhaps speaks to even a pre-Moorish presence in Montserrat surviving in the form of the Black Virgin through the present day. So, well, we'll have more to say about this later, and I'm not sure if I'm going to get to everything which I brought this evening, because I brought quite a lot, but I'm going to try to play more music from Catalonia and from Spain, and try to tie this opening rap about the Black Virgin together with... try to ultimately tie it into the current crisis which is brewing over Iraq. I'm not sure if we'll get quite that far. More ambitiously yet, we might try to take some phone calls. But before we do any of that, why don't I read some announcements? Just a few announcements, and then maybe we will take a brief musical break and then see just how far we make it into tonight's exploration. And speaking of the Iraq crisis, there is going to be an open forum on the impending war, as well as the state of the economy and the stolen election, Wednesday, October 30th, beginning at 2 p.m. at Lehman College in the Bronx. And that's featuring Stanley Aronowitz, the Green Party candidate for governor, as well as Green Party candidates for Congress, sponsored by the Lehman College Social Work Club and the Ad Hoc Faculty for a Political Forum. And this is all going to be happening in the Music Building, in the East Dining Room of the Music Building at Lehman College, up in the Bronx, 250 Bedford Park Boulevard West. And that's going to be 2 p.m. October 30th. So all of our Bronx listeners, please be there. Let's see what else we've got here. This coming Saturday, October 26th, Henry Kissinger, the former Secretary of State and notable war criminal, will be speaking in Dobbs Ferry in Westchester. And the East Timor Action Network and CASA Westchester will hold a peaceful vigil outside. That's going to be happening at the Masters School on Ashford Avenue near Route 9 in Westchester at 10:30 a.m. this October 26th, which is Saturday, this Saturday. And for more information, you can check out the East Timor Action Network website at http://etan, that's etan.org/news/Kissinger. And, of course, our friends at the East Timor Action Network are particularly concerned with Kissinger because he gave assent to Suharto's bloody invasion and subsequent genocide of East Timor way back in 1975. And when he was asked about it, he said something along the lines of, this is pretty close to verbatim, he said something along the lines of, oh, there's only a few hundred thousand East Timorese. Who cares? The world isn't going to notice. It wasn't worth alienating the Indonesian regime. Okay, also on the, continuing on the anti-war front here, there's going to be a Staten Island anti-war rally slash peace demonstration on November 2nd, beginning at 11 a.m., outside the offices of Representative Vito Fozella. And that's at 4434 Amboy Road near Richmond Avenue, opposite Perkins Restaurant in Eltingville, Staten Island. Sponsored by the Action Coalition of Staten Island. For more information, you can call the Action Coalition of Staten Island about this peace demonstration, which will be held at the offices of Representative Vito Fozella on November 2nd at 11 a.m. You can call the Action Coalition of Staten Island at 718-447-3464. That's 718-447-3464. And let's see, there is going to be, when is this going to be? October 25th. Wow, this is going straight on through for 6 hours. There's going to be for 24 hours, 24-hour horror movie marathon to benefit the Independent Zine Library at ABC No Rio, our beloved community center on the Lower East Side. $5 for 11 flicks, plus hot apple cider, free spooky buttons, a screen contest, and a raffle. 6 p.m. October 25th through 12 p.m. October 26th. So bring your pillows and PJs. Spread the word. The Zine Library is now almost at the 10,000 mark for radical titles and is in the process of scanning in the covers to every single zine for its website, which is at www.abcnorio.org. And dress like Jamie Lee Curtis or your favorite monster if the spirit moves you. Pass it on. Prizes include your very own copy of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and American Werewolf in London. So please be there. ABC No Rio, beginning at 6 p.m. on October 25th. ABC No Rio is at 56 Rivington Street, near the corner of Clinton on the Lower East Side. And what else have we got here? 156 Rivington Street? Yeah, okay, Bob corrects me. I had it right the first time. I corrected myself incorrectly. 156 Rivington Street, near the corner of Clinton on the Lower East Side. ABC No Rio. 24-hour horror movie marathon to commemorate Samhain, undoubtedly, and as a benefit for their Rockin' Zine Library, October 25th through 26th. And, okay, two more. On Wednesday, October 23rd, that is to say tomorrow, Women in Black New York will be moving their vigil from its regular site at the public library to the Isaiah Wall opposite the United Nations, right across First Avenue from the United Nations, at the usual time, 5:30 p.m. And this change is in honor of Gila Zversky's address to the Security Council. All are entitled to attend, and Gila Zversky is one of the original founders of the original Women in Black movement in Israel, a movement of women protesting the occupation of Palestine, a movement which was subsequently exported to Belgrade in Yugoslavia, Serbian women protesting the bloodshed in Bosnia and Kosovo, etc., and finally here to New York City and elsewhere around the world. And Gila Zversky has been a member of Women in Black since its founding in 1988. She is a co-founder of the Coalition of Women for a Just Peace, which brings together 9 Israeli women's peace organizations and has staged a number of dramatic acts of resistance to the occupation. Zversky has been an executive director of Bat Shalom and a chairperson of Betzalem, 2 leading peace and human rights organizations in Israel. Following the vigil, which is going to be, once again, across First Avenue from the United Nations at the Isaiah Wall, tomorrow, October 23rd, 5:30 p.m., following the vigil, a reception will be held at the Church Center at 777 UN Plaza, up on the second floor, beginning at 6:30 p.m. So whether you are a woman or not, and whether or not you are in black, you are encouraged to attend the Women in Black Vigil and Forum, which will be featuring one of the founders of the Women in Black movement, Gila Zversky, tomorrow, 6:30 p.m. at the Isaiah Wall. And finally, I'm announcing this again to remind myself as much as anybody else, because it's now been well more than a month that this exhibition has been showing, and I still haven't seen it yet, and I definitely intend to see it before it closes December 1st, and that is the at the International Center of Photography. 3 exhibitions that express the role that photography played in disseminating information, shaping opinion, and commemorating loss in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks. And the 3 projects include Under the Veil by the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, Final Exposures by photographer Bill Biggert, who was killed in the line of duty photographing the World Trade Center disaster. One of the 2 towers collapsed on top of him. His film survived, but he did not. And Jeff Mermelstein. His work entitled Ground Zero, September 11th. And this is all happening at the International Center of Photography, 1133 Avenue of the Americas, or as us New Yorkers call it, 6th Avenue, at 43rd Street, from September 13th through December 1st. So I'm reading this into the record to remind myself as much as the rest of you to check it out. And finally, Critical Mass, big Halloween Critical Mass, the biggest Critical Mass of the year, is happening this Friday, last Friday of the month, as always. So why don't we play that card again, Bob? Let's play that card. Now that it is 12:34 and listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, and I'm Bill Weinberg on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Critical Mass.
Come celebrate Halloween with Time's Up, a 15-year-old nonprofit environmental organization. On Friday, October 25th at 7 p.m., bike or skate to Union Square in your spookiest costume to join in the New York City Halloween Critical Mass Ride. Or join us later starting at 8 p.m. for the Halloween Dance Party at Walker Stage, 56 Walker Street. For more information, call Time's Up at 212-802-8222 or visit times-up.org. Remember, Friday, October 25th for the Time's Up Halloween Dance Party and Critical Mass Bike Ride. This has been a public service announcement courtesy of WBAI New York.
Okay, we're back, and I've just been informed by Sydney Smith that we are going off the air at 12:40 for approximately 5 minutes for maintenance. So that means in 5 minutes from now, we're going off the air. Is that correct? Sort of puts a cramp in my style here. Well, in that case, maybe we should... Excuse me? Yeah, it's not the 5 minutes. It's the fact that it interrupts the flow. Because I was about to go into a rant, and I don't want to interrupt the rant. So maybe instead we should play some music. And then I'll rant when we come out. But that's not going to leave me very much time to rant, is it? Especially if we're going to take phone calls. Okay, we're probably not going to take phone calls. Sorry, guys. Maybe we'll take phone calls next week. Let's see how much of this music we can get through. This will probably get us to let's see. Two, three, four. No, that's not even enough. No. All right, I need to rethink things here. Because now we only have 4 minutes before we're going off the air. Three and a half.
You use 4 minutes complaining about it.
That's true. I probably will. I'm just going to kvetch for 4 minutes.
You could have been doing your rant.
I know, but then it'll break my stride. All right, I'll tell you what. Why don't we play in that same disc which is in there. Why don't we play here? Let's hear more medieval music from Catalonia. How does that sound? In that same disc which is in there, why don't we play... why don't we play the last one? Let's play cut 10. Very noisy, very exuberant, and lyrics are very grim. Ad mortem festinamus, which translates as... Towards death we speed. Thank you. Yeah, that's the one that I wanted to play. That's Ad Mortem Festanamus. Towards death we speed. Okay, yeah, we were down for 5 minutes there. As Sydney explains, this is all 9/11 fallout, because the reason there's all of this ongoing work on the transmitter at the Empire State Building is, of course, they're trying to add, I guess you call it bandwidth there. Have I got the terminology right, Bob? No, I don't. in any event, they're trying to, you know, compensate for what was lost at the World Trade Center. So that's why we go down from time to time here on WBAI. And getting back to the contradictory relationship which Spain has with its Moorish past, even today, where it seems likely that the sacred mountain, sacred to, you know, deeply Catholic Catalonia, the sacred mountain of Catalonia seems to have been a Moorish stronghold. And in fact, you know, the reason that it's sacred may have to do with the fact that it was a Moorish stronghold. Let's talk a little bit about how this whole contradictory history played out in the amazing, heroic, and ultimately tragic events in Spain in those cataclysmic years between 1936 and 1939. You go to almost any church in Catalonia. Well, first I should say that Catalonia was the stronghold, the real hotbed of the Spanish anarchists during that period. And there is remarkably little evidence of, you know, of the war which shook Spain during those years today. It seems like it's a history that everybody just wants to forget. And it's still too controversial, even today, for there to be any historical markers. I mean, there are a few, but very, very few, considering that it wasn't all that long ago. I mean, there's plenty of people alive today who still remember it, still remember that period. You know, I mean, it was a horrible, bloody civil war, which shook Spain for 3 years. And, you know, there's very little very little visual evidence of it, as you just walk around Barcelona and so on. But one very obvious piece of evidence is that you go into just about any church, and there's always some kind of something there to inform you that the church was vandalized during the Civil War. And this, you know, it has to be said, was the work of the anarchists. the church was steadfastly behind the fascists in the Spanish Civil War. It has to be said that the church was really, really right there, you know, with Franco. And there was a tremendous evil relics have been, you know, were vandalized. It never actually says that it was by the anarchists, but, you know, it just says during the Civil War. But in fact, it was the anarchists. It was one of the more unfortunate excesses of the anarchist movement in those years. But, I mean, you know, obviously the anarchist movement in those years was I mean, a tremendous, you know, shining example of what is possible, where particularly in Barcelona and Catalonia, you know, the fascist revolt of General Franco was really crushed by the workers. And you know, industry was collectivized, and the, you know, the people were generally, you know, they were running the economy, especially in the city of Barcelona, and also out in the countryside. You know, the land was retaken and collectivized, not from above by bureaucrats, but from below by the peasants themselves and the factories. You know, taken over and collectivized from below by the workers themselves. And there was this, you know, shining moment there of not quite, let's see, when would it have been? It would have been from
from July of 1936 through May of 1937, so not quite a year. And then ultimately it was crushed not by the fascists, not by General Franco's forces, who took over in 1939, but initially in 1937, the anarchist movement in Catalonia was crushed by the Spanish Republic itself, which felt that things were just getting out of control in Barcelona. And let's talk about the Moorish dimension of this whole conflict. Okay, one of the ironies is that General Franco and the other generals who joined him in the fascist coup d'etat of July 1936, which they thought was going to be successful throughout Spain. It was not, and that's why there were 3 years of civil war before finally, unfortunately, the anarchists in Catalonia and the Spanish Republic in Madrid were defeated, and fascism came to power in Spain and remained in power in Spain until Franco's death in 1975, the last fascist country in Europe. And General Franco and the other generals who joined him in the revolt had all cut their teeth in the Moroccan campaigns in the 20s and the early 30s, maintaining control of the Spanish territory in Morocco. Most of Morocco was French at that point, but the Spanish had enclaves. In fact, the Spanish still have a few enclaves in Morocco, but they had more territory at that point, including some fairly rich mines where mineral wealth was being exploited. And along with the attendant, ecological degradation and land grabs and so on, and the building of mines and railroads across the territory of the Moorish and Berber peasants up in the Rif and Atlas Mountains, and which resulted in anti-colonialist revolts, quite predictably, and Franco was among the generals who was sent in there to put down these revolts. Franco and San Jorge, and Capo de Lando and Mola and the other generals who joined him in the attempted coup d'etat of July 1936 had all cut their teeth in the Moroccan campaign, as well as crushing workers' revolts, and miners' revolts, strikes and so on, by anarchist and socialist industrial workers and miners and so on in Catalonia and Asturias and elsewhere in Spain. But their real base of support was Morocco, and one of the ironies is that they formed their own Moroccan militias to fight other Moroccans, to put down these Moorish uprisings. They formed a Moorish legion. And these became the troops which were fanatically loyal to Franco and his followers. And when they originally declared their revolt, they declared it from Moroccan territory and also from the Canary Islands, and then proceeded to invade the Spanish mainland and called upon the generals in their barracks in the Spanish mainland to join them in their revolt, which many of them did. So when Franco's forces then invaded Spain in their effort to impose fascism, many of the troops which were fighting for them, fighting for Franco, fighting for fascism, were in fact Moorish troops from this these Moorish militias, or the Moorish Legion, which they had created initially to put down Moorish anti-colonialist revolts in Spanish Morocco. So the left wing forces of the Spanish Republic and as well as the anarchist and socialist workers' militias which resisted the fascist armies of Franco and his followers in Spain, were often fighting Moors. They were often fighting Moorish troops. And there was a certain amount of you know, overt racism, in fact, which accompanied this. And, you know, numerous writers have made the point, including George Orwell in Homage to Catalonia and Vernon Richards in Lessons of the Spanish Revolution, have made the point that one obvious move which the Spanish Republic could have made to try to weaken the Franco's forces, try to weaken the fascist forces, would have been to declare a Spanish Morocco independent, because this, you know, the fascists were using Spanish Morocco as a base of support, and it would have undermined this base if they had declared Morocco independent. This probably would have led to anti-colonialist revolts, further anti-colonialist revolts on the part of the Moors. And would have meant then that, you know, the fascists would have been fighting on two fronts. However, the Spanish Republican government in Madrid never made this move. It was a lack of courage and a lack of vision on their part. Despite all of their anti-fascist rhetoric and all of their socialist rhetoric, and in fact their genuine socialist ideals, they never took, you know, the elementary anti-colonialist step of declaring the independence of Spanish Morocco. And this was one of the reasons that they came under a great deal of criticism from the Spanish anarchists. And they were ostensibly on the same side as the Spanish anarchists at first. They were all, you know, together in anti-fascist solidarity. But, you know, eventually the... By May of 1937, when the Republican government decided to crack down on the anarchists, predominantly in Catalonia, the contradictions within the anti-fascist ranks became evident, and this was one of the bases of that contradiction. It's 2 minutes after 1 o'clock in the morning. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade and listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. But even some of the anarchists sort of fell prey to this whole unfortunate dynamic where, you know, the fascists were using the Moors as cannon fodder, and therefore this resulted in pro-colonialist sentiment, actually, on the part of the anti-fascist forces. Another big divisions within the anarchist movement itself early on was whether or not, in fact, to support the Spanish Republic, which was, you know, under siege by Franco's forces. And the anarchists themselves were divided on this, and a few of them actually took cabinet positions within the... briefly took cabinet positions within the Spanish Republican government before the purge. They were eventually purged at the same time in May of 1937, at the same time that the Republican government decided to crack down on the anarchists. The anarchists who actually held cabinet posts in the Republican government were all purged. And of course, you know, the notion of anarchists holding cabinet posts is a contradictory one, and the more ideologically pure or hardcore anarchists in the movement, such as Buenaventura Durruti, were extremely critical of their comrades who they felt had sold out by taking cabinet posts. But one of those who did take cabinet posts was Federica Montseny. And she became Minister of Health in the Madrid government. And here's what she had to say in one of her many diatribes against Franco's forces. Here's a part of what she had to say. With this enemy, meaning Franco and the fascists, this enemy lacking dignity or a conscience, without a feeling of being Spaniards. Because if they were Spaniards, if they were patriots, they would not have let loose on Spain the Moors to impose the civilization of the fascists, not as Christian civilization, but as a Moorish civilization. People we went to colonize for them, and now have come back to colonize us with religious principles and political ideas which they wish to impose on the minds of the Spanish people. That is Federica Monsani, the contradictory anarchist minister of health in the Republican government in August of 1936, as quoted in the anarchist newsweekly Solidaridad Obrera, as quoted in the book Lessons of the Spanish Revolution by Vernon Richards. So as we can see, this extremely contradictory notion of colonialist anti-fascism, if you would, or racist anti-fascism, even infected some of our anarchist heroes and heroines. And of course, unfortunately, and Orwell is, very clear on this point in Homage to Catalonia. Unfortunately, people during those years who raised criticisms of the Republican government, even who raised criticisms of the Republican government from an anti-colonialist perspective, criticizing them, for instance, on their failure to declare the independence of Spanish Morocco, and criticized them, in fact, for imposing capitalism, for reimposing capitalism in Spain by crushing the anarchist revolutionaries in Catalonia. Nonetheless, the people who made such criticisms were invariably criticized and lambasted and accused by the communists, by the Stalinists, accused of being fascist sympathizers, of being fifth column fascists, of being Franco's dupes, etc., etc., etc. And in fact, that was, that was all of the rhetoric which was behind the purge of May of 1937, where ironically, forces which were to the left of the Republican government, anarchist forces which had, spontaneously collectivized industry and agriculture in Catalonia, and had actually, got a real revolutionary movement going on and were expropriating the wealth of the bourgeoisie, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, were accused of being fifth column fascists and of being Franco's dupes because they weren't buckling under and, accepting the line of Madrid, that, everything, all orders have got to come from Madrid, from the Republican government in Madrid, which in turn was, it has to be said, under orders from Moscow. I mean, Moscow, Russia was the only, Soviet Union was just about the only world power which came to the defense of civilian Spain. The British and the French and the United States sat out the war and, in fact, aided Franco, aided the fascists. There was an official arms embargo which was imposed, but there wasn't any arms embargo that Hitler and Mussolini were recognizing. They, of course, were aiding the fascists. And whereas the Western democracies were refusing to aid the anti-fascist forces. And in fact, the various American oil companies, including Texaco, sold oil, not arms, but oil to Franco's forces. So the Republican government, really one of the few friends that they had, just about the only friend they had, apart from the Cardenas regime in Mexico, was the Stalin regime in Russia. So they were sort of put in a position where they had to take orders from Moscow, and they did. And, you know, for reasons which are understandable, but perhaps not forgivable. But in any event, you know, we have to understand, you know, the irony here that when capitalism was restored in Spain, it was in the name of, paradoxically, in the name of anti-fascism. And in fact, it was a policy which was being handed down from Moscow. And, you know, I think about all of this stuff, and I'll see if I can get through what I wanted to get through in the 20 minutes remaining to me. I think about all of this history when I think about the politics of the anti-war movement in this country currently, and I think about the current crisis which is brewing over Iraq. And I just got a flyer today about the big march on Washington, which is happening this Saturday, October 26th. And this flyer reads, "Stop the war on Iraq before it starts." And there's an awful lot of talk which is coming out of the left, including certain sectors on WBAI, about imperialist and Zionist conspiracies to dismember Iraq. And undoubtedly they exist, you know, but Iraq is not an ethnically homogenous state. Iraq is a creation, in fact, of colonialism. A creation of British imperialism in the aftermath of the First World War, when the Brits took that territory off of the Turkish Ottoman Empire and sort of arbitrarily drew the lines of the region, drew the borders of the region. As has been made clear in the book War Plan, 10 Reasons Against War on Iraq by Milan Rai, with a chapter by Noam Chomsky, hot off the presses from Verso Books. And obviously, you know, this is an anti-war book, obviously. This book, the entire thrust of this book is against intervention in Iraq, against the sanctions, against any renewed military campaign. But the facts which are an analysis which are brought to bear are more sophisticated than many which you're going to get from elsewhere in the left. I'm going to read just a little bit about this. Let's just read a little bit from this book, War Plan Iraq, 10 Reasons Against the War on Iraq by Milan Rai. And in this context, Milan is talking about regime destabilization, 2002, and all of the intrigues on the part of the White House to try to create a post-Saddam order in Iraq. And Milan argues that it really has less to do. Here, the subtitle of this chapter is "The U.S. Pursues Leadership Change, Not Regime Change." So this isn't, in fact, about any kind of meaningful regime change in Iraq. It's about reshuffling the leadership and getting compliant leadership in power. And it really doesn't, I mean, Iraq is not an ethnically homogenous state. Iraq is, you know, the Sunni Arabs are a minority. The Sunni Arabs, who constitute the heartland of Iraq around Baghdad, from whom the administrative elite is overwhelmingly, if not exclusively, drawn, are they're a minority in Iraq of around 30% of the country, with the remainder being the Shiites, or so-called marsh Arabs, in the south, in the Shatt al-Arab region, and the Kurds in the north. So rather than looking at this as some kind of a conspiracy to dismember Iraq, we should perhaps look at it as the Shiites and the Kurds have legitimate grievances and aspirations. And these are, of course, going to be exploited and manipulated by U.S. imperialism. But that does not mean that U.S. imperialism has any genuine commitment to any kind of meaningful independence or even autonomy. It all depends on what is expedient for imperialism, and that may prove expedient or it may not prove expedient. But we don't want to fall into the position of, in the name of anti-imperialism, supporting the colonialist structures which were imposed upon that part of the world by the colonialist powers in the aftermath of the First World War. Much as in the name of opposing fascism, much of the left and the world communist movement supported colonialism, Spanish colonialism, in Morocco in the 1930s. Now to read from War Plan Iraq by Milan Rai. Modern Iraq was formed by Britain. In October 1914, the First World War extended into a war between the Ottoman and British empires, and Britain landed an expeditionary force near Basra, soon capturing the Ottoman province of that name. By the end of 1918, Britain had conquered the three provinces of Basra, Baghdad, and Mosul, a conquest which led directly to the integration of the three territories into the unitary state of Iraq under a British imperial mandate. At the beginning of the mandate, there were 3 million Iraqis, of whom more than half were Shia Muslim and a fifth were Kurdish, while 8% of the population was comprised of the Jewish, Christian, Yazidi, Sabaean, and Turkoman minorities. Yet the government ministers, the senior state officials, and the officer corps of the armed forces were drawn almost exclusively from the Sunni Arabs, who formed less than 20% of the population. The Sunni-dominated order of Ottoman times was re-established by the British. At the Cairo Conference of March 1921, convened by Winston Churchill, the decision was taken to establish the Kingdom of Iraq and to offer the throne to a member of the Hashemite royal family, Amir Faisal, who had fled from Syria after the collapse of a similar British arrangement. Historian Charles Tripp of the School of Oriental and African Studies in London remarks, "As a public figure, he was regarded as having a natural authority in the Arab world, but equally importantly, he was believed to be amenable to British advice and well aware of the limitations that the reality of British power in the Middle East would place upon his ambitions." The key to British decision-making was to choose weak partners who would be reliant on outside power, British power. King Faisal was an outsider with no roots in Iraq who understood his subordinate position. The Sunni generals and ministers who ran Iraq were equally aware of their minority position within the new state and the significance of British power in maintaining the unity of the, quote, nation, unquote, as demonstrated by the role of the Royal Air Force in crushing the independent-minded Kurds and maintaining Baghdad's rule over the northern province of Mosul. The Sunni Muslim minority now makes up a third of the population of Iraq, but continues to dominate the centers of power. Iraq refers to the Sunni Arab heartland as the center, a geographical, political, and social and economic term. The key clans within the center are drawn from the four central provinces of Baghdad, Tikrit, Mosul, somewhat smaller than its Ottoman predecessor, and Ramadi. Saddam Hussein himself comes from the Tikriti group of clans, and has a long habit of positioning members of his own Bajat clan in key posts in the political system. Within the insecurity of the Sunni Muslims, outnumbered by the disenfranchised mass of the Shia majority and the large Kurdish minority, lies the even more intense insecurity of the more privileged Takriti clans. Informed U.S. analysts Anthony H. Kordsman and Ahmed S. Hashim comment, in the past, Saddam has been able to count upon the loyalty of these Takritis for a number of reasons. The kinship ties between them, the material benefits and power he has given them, and their role in creating a strong and powerful Iraq, one where they benefit from corruption and a phenomenal growth in wealth. The Takritis have learned to fear Saddam's personal ruthlessness, and Saddam's actions have shown even his closest associates that they can lose power or die as easily as Hussein Kamel, the dictator's own son-in-law. At the same time, they have good reason to fear his fall. They know that if Saddam goes, whether by their hands or the hands of non-Takritis, they may also fall, and do so at the cost of their lives. As a result, the Takritis face a Hobson's choice. Many increasingly fear Saddam and want him out of power because his presence endangers them and their gains, but they also fear that they fear what would happen to their gains and their lives if they were to remove him. There is a network of perhaps 500,000 people who are attached to the Iraqi president by ties of blood or tried and tested dedication to his personal service, or who are dependent on networks of patronage and association that extend from his inner circle. These are the people whom Saddam Hussein needed to convince both that his leadership was better for their interest than any imaginable alternative, and that they would lose everything if he were to be overthrown and a new dispensation of power established itself in Baghdad. This mass of people is sometimes known as the Umana Saddam, or Saddam's faithful. Beyond his own clan networks, the Iraqi leader has also used the same mechanism of control used by his Ottoman and British predecessors, patronage of tribal sheikhs. In the 1990s, Baghdad brought back a form of separate jurisdiction for the tribal areas that recall the days of the British-imposed monarchy. The firing of a rifle or a pistol in the air, an act often used by the Western media to emphasize Mr. Saddam's militaristic and aggressive character, is actually an act which symbolized a kind of traditional Iraqi celebration, the Hosa, according to a rare academic study of the Shia population of Iraq. It is one of the devices used by the Iraqi leadership to emphasize and strengthen the tribal and national identities of Iraq's majority Shia population and to undermine the political significance of their religious affiliation. The Iraqi center is the focus of Washington's attentions. And the author goes on to talk about the Iraqi National Accord, one of the groups which is now being funded by the CIA, which is made up of solid Sunni military officers and is thought to be key to the palace coup, which can achieve the twin goals of regime stabilization and leadership change. In the words of historian Charles Tripp, the favored method of the Iraqi National Accord, or INA, has been the exploitation of kinship and other informal links within the armed forces to bring about a successful coup d'etat against Saddam Hussein. And then the author goes on to look at the various potentials for a so-called man on a white horse, that is, a potential leader of a coup d'etat against Saddam Hussein, who could be groomed by the White House to take over. And invariably, exclusively, all of these figures come from Saddam's own inner circle, from the own so-called Umana Saddam, Saddam's faithful, or alienated elements within Saddam's faithful. But invariably from the Takriti tribes and the Sunni heartland, who are loyal to Saddam. and a little bit more historical background, and then I'll wrap it up. The CIA is no stranger to coup plots in Iraq. According to Saddam Hussein's biographer, there was a joint CIA Ba'ath Party conspiracy against Iraqi President General Abdul Karim Qasim, who was the general who led the initial coup against the British-installed monarchy back in the early 1960s. The plans to overthrow the Iraqi leader, that is, General Karim Qasim, led by William Lakeland, who was stationed at the Baghdad embassy as an attaché, represented one of the most elaborate CIA operations in the history of the Middle East. One element of the preparation for the coup was CIA liaison with minor Ba'athists in Egypt, including a man by the name of Saddam Hussein, who was then a militant in the Ba'ath Party, which is, of course, today the ruling party in Iraq in the one-party dictatorship of Saddam Hussein. In the aftermath of the coup, there was an elimination campaign against communists and leftists. Qasim had been overthrown in part because of his leftward tendencies. And, of course, the coup which originally ousted Qasim was led by the Ba'ath Party. It was the first coup d'etat by the Ba'ath Party, which would eventually bring Saddam Hussein to power. Said Saeed Aborish has compiled a list of 800 names of those killed in the coup. 800 names of those killed in the coup. The total is thought to be higher. The new Iraqi regime worked from lists of communists provided by the CIA. Some names were apparently fed to the CIA by Saddam Hussein himself. Ali Salah al-Saadi, who became the Minister of the Interior and Deputy Prime Minister, said, "We came to power on a CIA train." Another element of the CIA Ba'athist coup was the withdrawal of CIA support to a Kurdish rebellion that had been going on for 2 years. After the 1963 coup, the U.S. flew in arms from Turkey and Iran, then under the Shah, to enable the new government to crush the Kurds. All of this despite the fact that the Kurds had been consulted about the coup in advance and had given their tacit cooperation. The foreshadowing of the present U.S. project is eerie and a grim portent for Iraq's Kurds. So there you have it, folks. We have to be out of here right now. I've been reading from the book War Plan Iraq, 10 Reasons Against the War on Iraq by Milan Rai, hot off the presses from Verso Press. So don't believe the hype is all I can say. Whether the hype is coming from Washington and the mainstream media, or the hype is coming from certain elements on the left in the anti-war movement in this country, don't believe the hype. Saddam Hussein himself apparently vigorously cooperated with the CIA in a coup d'etat which led to the mass murder of communists and leftists in Iraq back in the 1960s, something, you know, with the CIA up to its ears in it, something akin to Suharto's coup in Indonesia in 1967, I believe it was, or Pinochet's coup in Chile in 1973. And the Kurds and the Shiites in Iraq, who have occasionally been groomed by Washington as proxies to fight the Baghdad regime, have just as often been sold down the river by Washington when it was deemed in the interest of Washington once again to shore up the state of Iraq, which had been largely arbitrarily created by British imperialism. We have to be out of here. I hope I haven't been too all over the place tonight, but stay tuned for Weaponry coming up next. Join us 1 week from tonight when Anne-Marie Hendrickson will be back here, I believe, with a special on the art and science of professional wrestling. Until then, stay tuned to listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, and Salam Aleikum. I wanted to play Goddamn Confused. I've got too many CDs. I'm trying to juggle here. Cut one on the other one. That's right, cut one. No, not cut one. Wait a minute. Cut three. Cut three. There you go. Cut three. Thank you.
Ave Maria, 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 Ave Maria,